Welcome to What Am I Missing? I'm Ben.
And I am Andy, drinking coffee unprofessionally.
A show where we talk about various things that we find interesting in the world of pop culture. Mm-hmm. And this week we have a particularly interesting topic, one that I wanted to bring up anyway. And seriously, I haven't seen a lot of people talking about it as regards to all media, which is endings, and do they actually matter?
I have to say, when you came to me with that question, my first thing was endings as a topic. And I was like, that's an interesting topic because there's an awful lot of endings that are kind of underwhelming.
Yeah.
Especially in the last kind of few years. Like, it seems like nobody knows how to write a fucking ending anymore. Like the endings are always kind of, not bad, but just kind of,
you know.
And at first I thought that's a good topic, and then I looked at the question, like, do they matter? And it was really interesting, because I kind of found that even though a lot of endings have let me down recently, I still look very favorably on a lot of that content.
Yeah, and that's kind of what, like, why I was thinking about it. And it first popped up to me when I was just on YouTube, and somebody was talking about the ending to Bioshock Infinite, which is, like, a weird thing to bring up sort of 6 years after after the game's come out, and Irrational Games doesn't even exist anymore. It seems a very strange time to start, like, talking about how...
Yeah, come on, man. Where were you? Like, what year did that come out?
Was it 2013 or something?
Something like that. God damn it, come on.
Yeah, and I just found it very, very strange. And also, like, you know, there are a lot of criticisms people throw at Bioshock Infinite, but I don't think the story has really ever been one, or the ending in particular.
No. I mean, Bioshock Infinite, for me, I really liked it. First of all, I really liked it, and it's a good one. It's a good one to start with, because my main complaint about Bioshock Infinite was that it was for my tastes, it was too. Parts of it seemed too generic. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it was kind of like, it was this fantastic, bold new setting and this great new idea, and it was like this. It wasn't like just a normal shooter, but then occasionally it was just a normal shooter, and I was a little bit disappointed with that. But generally speaking, it's a really good game. Now, the ending is quite an interesting place to start this conversation, because Sean O'Kaneda, who's a friend of mine, he was the one who kind of convinced me to be a fan of the Bioshock Infinite ending. Because when I first played it, I was so confused. I was completely, completely lost by that ending. And even now, I still can't quite remember exactly what happened or why I was so confused. I was blown away by the meta commentary that it gave. Like, the whole thing of there's always a castle, there's always a girl. Like, loved that. That was fantastic. And the moment you... Oh, spoilers, by the way. Big spoilers.
Well, I mean, we're talking about endings.
Yeah. Like, spoilers. The rapture moment. Mind blown. But, like, in terms of what actually happens in the narrative line, I was really confused. And Sean has never played Bioshock Infinite, to my knowledge. But he came over right after I finished it, and I was complaining to him that I'd finished this game, and I didn't like the ending. He is super into time travel. Mm-hmm. He's a big time travel guy, and big on kind of multiverse stuff, and he loves that shit.
Yeah.
So I explained to him what happened in the ending and the story, and he, without ever playing the game, he got it immediately, and he drew me like a diagram. On like a napkin, he took out a pen and drew me a diagram of a timeline. I was like, okay, well, Booker, clearly he just went here, and he came back here, and then this is what happened here, and... After he explained it, I was like, cool. Yeah, actually, like, I kind of get it now. But it was... Did you feel it was presented in a way that was easily digestible?
But this is kind of where I get some... Like, firstly, I think it did... Personally, I got it. I kind of understood what it was going for. There was a divergent point. In every multiverse, there is a book. There was a Booker. There was an Elizabeth. Mm. Or something, then that, like, at some point the Booker peels off into a Booker and a Comstock, like, in every universe and all the rest of it. So, like, you know, I got all that, but also it didn't matter because that wasn't really what the ending was about. It was about Booker's relationship to Elizabeth. And that and that's kind of why, like, you know, when people talk about the ending of, like, oh, and it's, you know, multiverses and all the rest of it, it's just like, no. It's about somebody making up for the mistake that they made, like, and really showing that despite the thing, their actions of the past, they did care about their daughter, and they were super sorry about it, and they are giving up on their life to show that they did care about it. It's a game much earlier than, like, the current fad of, like, fathers and daughters, like, you know, of family and trying to do what's best for your children and all the rest of it.
Yeah, you're right. It is one of those things where how multi-layered can your ending be? Like, how many different kind of... Because I know some people felt like, and initially, like we talked about, there's the Rapture moment and the meta commentary on games in general, and some people felt like the whole ending to Bioshock Infinite was actually a reference to game endings in general. It was like a commentary on the fact that game endings are very difficult to get right and kind of underwhelming. And I don't personally, that wasn't my interpretation of it. My interpretation of it was nothing. I couldn't figure out what was going on. But I think you've hit a good point there. It's not so much about, well, it depends on what you think, I guess. But I agree with you that it's not so much about the time travel stuff. It's more specifically about that relationship.
So
Bioshock Infinite is a good place to start. But where else would you like to take this conversation about ending?
I mean, I think it's all about, like, you know, in so many aspects of all media. I mean, not just video games. I think video games have been the biggest culprits or like the biggest discussion points. More recently, but, like, I mean, how many films do people say, oh, that ending sucked?
How long has it been a meme, almost? Like, before memes were memes, there was the idea that the good guys always win. Like, that is running meme ever. So, inevitably, endings are always going to be somewhat underwhelming, and I guess what it comes down to is more about how you present it.
And that is true, but does it matter in the larger aspects? What I'm thinking of, let's take a really famous example. You've seen The Lord of the Rings, right?
Yeah.
The ending of Return of the King.
I don't remember it, but I didn't like those movies, so.
Oh, okay. Ooh.
I just lost a lot of nerd points. I know,
It's generally considered, like, the weakest part of all the films. Okay. It's because it's just, they take forever. There's so many of them. There's never, like, you know, it's never just one ending. It's like, oh, now we've got to say goodbye to everybody here. And all the rest of it.
I do remember this. Yeah. I do remember this. I thought it was over, like, four times.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so, okay.
So it's... But those films are, you know, present company,
generally accepted as fantastic movies. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
People love them. So does the actual fact that there are too many endings and people don't like the ending, does it actually matter in the larger context of the film? Like, does the rest of it work?
Well, a little bit. I think that's an interesting question. And I think the first thing that came to my mind when you just said it was, like, going back to what we said about Star Wars. Star Wars has transcended George Lucas. You know what I mean? I think that if something becomes popular enough for whatever reason, if it takes hold of people's imaginations, then to an extent, the actual narrative line or any one particular narrative line does kind of become irrelevant. You know, how many different stories are there in the Star Wars universe now? There's fucking thousands. So is A New Hope more relevant than...
A New Hope is a great example of a terrible ending. Like, like, people think it ends with the blowing up of the Death Star. That's not it. Like, it ends with that weird ceremony that they have. Where they're all getting medals and everyone stands around and laughs and all this. Like, it's a... Given the explosions and everything else, the action packs...
It's fantastically generic.
It's just like, what is happening? Like, it's... This is so bizarre. Like,
but do you know what I mean? Like, there are so, because there are so many strands in that universe now, is any one strand particularly more relevant than any other one? And I would say no, not really. So if the individual narrative lines are not as important as the overall universe, then surely the endings of each narrative line are kind of irrelevant. So when you talk about Lord of the Rings, I think it's kind of the same thing. I think people are just so enamored with Lord of the Rings as a cultural concept rather than as a story that the ending is kind of, it's almost after the fact. It doesn't really matter. Yeah, so it doesn't matter. It's just like, that's the ending of the story, but that's not why I'm here. Okay. I'm here because of the world and the characters and everything else. So the ending is just kind of something that's there and I can like it or not like it, but it's...
Okay, so these are like like those two, and I guess you could probably include the Harry Potter series as well, which is also a very divisive ending.
Yeah.
Like, you
also
know,
when does it end? I mean, fantastic. Harry Potter. I mean, is it ever going to end? There's always a phase play.
I don't... Have you read The Cursed Child?
No.
Oh my god, it's terrible. Like, it's so bad. Like, but these are like huge, as you said, like kind of huge, like they've been superseded by their own worlds. Yeah, like, yeah, there's the actual stories of it. So what about, have you seen AI?
Oh, the thing with Jude Law?
Yeah, Jude Law and Haley Joel Osment and, yeah, and
I saw
Ben
it a
Kingsley.
Long time ago. Like a long time ago. I think I might have been too young and immature to understand or pay attention to it.
It's a very... like, because I'm a massive defender of this film, and not many people really kind of like it, or they think it's only kind of okay and all the rest
of it.
Well,
I know it has a cult following.
Yeah. And, like, the ending is problem is kind of weird. Like, and a lot of people don't get it, and because it's Spielberg trying to pay homage to Kubrick, who passed, and Kubrick really wanted this ending, despite everybody telling him it's a stupid ending, so Spielberg felt he needed to have the ending and all the rest of it. So, like...
What happens? I mean, we're already past the spoiler door, and I've seen the movie, I just can't remember. So.
Yeah, yeah. So, basically, it's the story of a robot boy trying to become human.
Yeah.
So he gets frozen in this after finding out who his creator was and all the rest of it, and then he ends up being unfrozen by what people keep on calling aliens, but they're actually what it's supposed to be is the full development of robots.
Oh, okay.
These kind of like screen faces and like you know, and intelligences, and he's given one last wish for one day with his mother, and then he falls asleep forever for the first time in his like life.
He sleeps, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that being a thing, that he didn't sleep.
Yeah.
And the parents were freaked out by that at one point, right?
Yeah. I remember that. And he is rewarded with this, like, you know, for being effectively becoming human.
Okay.
He is rewarded by getting sleep. It's a fairy tale, like, so that's the thing. And people hate this ending. They're like, oh, it's so stupid. It just ruins the film. It ruins all the weird stuff.
Why is it stupid?
I think because it doesn't have the grime that the rest of the film does. Like, you know, there's the rest of the film, like, you got Jude Law, the gigolo robot. You've got, like, you know, humans holding robot death matches and where they kill.
Okay, so this is a good example then, because this is something that we've actually talked about before, and occasionally we come out on the same side of it, and occasionally we don't. Right, and for me, it's a really interesting aspect of criticism, particularly media criticism, especially when there's a story involved in whatever you're criticizing. Because it took me a long time to kind of realize that I always liked certain critics and disliked certain critics, and I always liked certain types of criticism and disliked certain types of criticism, and I never really understood why. I was like, what is the difference between this guy and this guy? Why do I like this guy more than this guy, and blah, blah, blah. And ultimately, I feel like what it comes down to is that a lot of people criticize from the point of view of looking at something and complaining that it's not something else, as opposed to looking at something and objectively criticizing what it is, right? So people kind of go, I would say, from what you're describing in that case, I would say those fans are looking at that ending and saying, oh, well, we wanted it to be grimier. We wanted it to be more Blade Runner-y or something. We wanted it to be more, as opposed to saying, well, is this ending appropriate for the story that precedes it? Does it work in the context of this movie? I mean, maybe I would have liked something a little bigger or flashier, but is it bad? Like, is it inappropriate? Is it out of place? Is there anything objectively negative about it? No. Well, then it comes down to subjective personal choice. I just don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. You can say I don't like something. That's totally fine. But it doesn't... You not liking something doesn't necessarily reflect badly on the quality of the thing.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think it's a really... Especially with endings, it's a really important thing to talk about. Because people disagree hugely on narrative lines. Like, on what narrative lines means. You know what I mean? And I think we... Before we started recording, we brought up Final Fantasy XV.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good one to talk about. So how did you feel about...
I'll just preface this by, like, saying... Movies do have, like, a lot of, like, endings that can kill or save... A movie. I think one of the biggest examples recently for most people was the ending of Rogue One with Vader in the corridor.
That's like for
even people who don't like the film particularly are like, that scene was amazing. So, but you're right. With video games, we have such a different, like, there's so, almost a more volatile reaction to endings.
Usually, it's.
Like, despite everything that comes before it. So, yeah, Final Fantasy 15. I kind of... Like, I mean, I love the game despite how incredibly dumb it is. Like, it is so... Like, the game is dumb. Hey,
we're not here to rag on Final Fantasy
15. I'm not ragging. It's great.
I'm a Final Fantasy fanboy, by the way, for those of you who don't know. So, like, it's, fuck.
Yeah, look.
Fuck you.
But it's so dumb.
It's not dumb, man. It's not dumb. It was in development for 15 years.
Yeah, and that, like, and if it's in development for the 15 years and that is the kind of storyline and stuff that they could come up with,
was a troubled game, and it's trouble shows occasionally. I'm not gonna be a fanboy about it. Yeah.
Okay. Like, yeah. But you know, the characters are great, but the problem I have with the ending is that in many ways it's really kind of like rushed, and it kind of comes out of nowhere,
I agree with that.
You know, it's just like suddenly Noctis is in a crystal and he's kind of germinating while Arden covers the world in darkness, and then you go and kill all the demons and then Arden, and then you fly and then you're dead.
Yeah,
with Luna Freya, the one true love that you didn't really want at the beginning of the game. Like, you know, yeah, like, this is a weird ending.
It is a weird ending. It is. You're absolutely right. Now, where I stand on the ending is kind of summarizes my position on Final Fantasy XV in general. As a huge Final Fantasy fan, I have, for the last kind of 12 to 13 years, or however long it was, I have been aware of Final Fantasy 15, as it was called back in the day, Final Fantasy Versus 13, right? And Noctis as a character, and the idea that you were going to be this guy who could control these swords, and a city-based Final Fantasy game, not GTA-like, but you know what I mean? As opposed to a fantasy world of exploring vast wildernesses and stuff, you're going to be in cities.
Yeah.
Consistently. And that kind of thing was really interesting and super exciting, and It's so strange now to look at the game that we got, which, by the way, I really enjoyed. I think as an entry into Final Fantasy canon, it works really well. It's very tonally appropriate. It works as a Final Fantasy game, but at the same time, it kind of reinvents the franchise and points to other things that could happen in the future. But it's really strange when you look at, take a bigger view, not just of the game itself, but of the kind of the meme of the game. You know what I mean? Like the kind of the meta story, the narrative outside the game of how it happened and why it happened and why it was so delayed. There's so much content supposedly from this game that was cut, that was redesigned and rethought. And the character of Luna Freya comes from an earlier character called Stella, who was cut. And there was like a whole sequence. You can watch it on Twitch. I'm sure it's somewhere out there. There was a whole 20-minute video like cutscene that was either released or leaked. I can't remember when, like a long time ago, of Noctis and Stella,
right,
as teenagers, just talking about their lives and talking about, you know, their royal lineage and their royal parentage and stuff. And it's I would assume it's sowing story seeds, because I can't imagine a 20-minute cutscene would be like without purpose. But and a 20-minute cutscene, fucking thank God it was cut. But but the point is that not only was that scene cut, that whole thing isn't there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Stella has become Lunafreya,
and that relationship and is that relationship not the is same. Not there. Like it's
so like we're told they're childhood friends.
Yeah,
but we're never shown it.
We see some kind of things where they meet as children, but yeah. there's no
depth to their relationship at all. It does not. We're told to care.
Yeah.
But it's never shown to us why we should care.
No,
so, narratively, Final Fantasy XV is a really bizarre game. And I think that my personal feeling is that its development troubles took a toll on its narrative. No one knows if that's true. Only the guys who made it know if that's true. But that's my feeling from it. But anyway, to get to the ending, you're absolutely correct. The ending is rushed like fuck, right? But it's symptomatic of the reason that I went back and wanted to talk about that whole concept is because the ending being rushed, I don't think it's just the ending. I think that in general, the ending...
Are you going to claim that a game that was delayed for 10 years or whatever is rushed? Like it feels
but
rushed.
Here's the thing. Yeah, it shouldn't, right? But the narrative really does. And it does because... I'm gonna say that the ending is actually kind of appropriate to the story structure of Final Fantasy XV. Not as a compliment to the game, as a criticism of the game. In that so much of the narrative consistently from the beginning seems to have come out of nowhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like it's a recurring theme. Like someone will say, "Oh, we have to kill the Titan." Is it Titan? What the fuck? Why are you all talking about this Titan like it was common knowledge? Like, and Prompto going, "Oh, by the way, I'm half robot."
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
What that the was... fuck? What,
and they never mentioned again. Like...
Never mentioned again. And then like the Shiva decides to freeze the whole world at one point.
Yeah,
and it's like what the fuck? What? Shiva was my friend. What's going on? Like, there's so many points in it where plot points are just like plucked out of the sky and shoved in front of you. And they don't make any sense. That by the time I got to the ending, that didn't really bother me anymore. It was like, oh, good, another fucking thing I didn't know about. But where I think that Final Fantasy XV's ending actually kind of saves the game is in its presentation. And this is what we were talking about before, where maybe the presentation is more important than anything else, because the moment where Noctis dies... No, the moment where Noctis reveals that he has to die to his friends is, for me, very reminiscent of the moment when Tidus finds out that Yuna is going to die in 10. And it's a really good scene in 10. It's like 10 is a fantastic linear line, narrative line. 10 is a masterpiece of storytelling. So like it doesn't have the same issues, but it felt like a kind of a reference to that and a callback to that. And then the whole thing with him... sacrificing himself and the final scene with him on the throne with Lunafreya, and then that becomes the logo, and then the menu transforms from dark to light. Like, the presentation of the ending for me made me fanboy out. I was just like, okay. Oh, this is so cool. And like you just said, the characters are really good. If the characters hadn't been good, I think everyone would have hated this game.
Right.
I really think it's the characters that carry it. And so when Noctis had to die and you saw the character's reaction to that and you felt, for me, it was like the group is going to break up because Noctis isn't going to be around anymore. That was really sad.
Yeah.
And when he says, when it happens, I did find myself kind of going, all right, I knew we were heading towards a rushed ending and I was convinced it was going to let me down, but I'm moved by this. Like, I actually care about these characters.
So it kind of like the ending did manage to save it for you.
For me, it did.
Like, it managed to save the rest of it. So in that case, the ending did matter.
It did matter for me there. Yeah,
oh, yeah.
It did matter. Now the other thing about Final Fantasy XV, I mean, it's a weird case because, like we just said, the narrative makes no sense. But I think you would agree there are moments. It's punctuated by moments where of like not narrative. It's punctuated by moments of just kind of. really nice world building. Like, there's a scene at one of the diners with Noctis and Prompto, where you talk about, you're just talking to Prompto, and he's, Prompto talks to you about his insecurities and how he's like, well, you guys are, you're royalty, he's really strong, he's really smart, what the hell am I? Why am I here? And there's a few different options you can take. You can be a dick, I think, is one of the, a few of the dialogue options aren't very nice. But it's a nice scene, and it kind of fills out this relationship between Prompto and Noctis. And then there's other scenes where the other character, Gladio and Ignis, will ask you to come off with them on their missions. And they're really nice. They're nice little moments. So it's like, okay, the narrative isn't very good, but the character building is really good.
But the problem is, it's only the character building between those four. Because you have side characters who should be interesting. Like, Luna Freya should be a really interesting character.
Yeah, she's not. Yeah, she's Arden, super underdeveloped.
Arden is just, like, he's just there some of the time and bees like and to be, like, kind of malevolent and all the rest of it.
I would say Arden is, like, maybe the most criminally underused villain in Final Fantasy history. Because his when it's finally revealed what his thing is, that's a great backstory.
Yeah, his reasoning is really, really cool. Mm. His logic is kind of like interesting.
Yeah,
and like if that was like if I understood the world a bit more, I would actually care. Like, yes. But this is the problem is like if story and character are really, really closely linked. That doesn't mean just the central characters. We need to have, like, you know, characters, like, side characters, like, villains doing actions that would actually, like, develop the story in interesting ways and show their character. Not just turn up on a train and be really, really weird.
You hit the nail on the head there. You hit the nail on the head.
And I think that's why the ending doesn't work as well for me. And it doesn't matter, because I still thought that the whole game was stupid campy fun.
Right.
And like the ending is kind of stupid fun. Right, okay. I mean, it's totally consistent for me.
Yeah, okay.
But like the whole point of the why you and Ardent are suddenly flying around and then you're on the ground again without any powers and then you fight again in a weird world?
It's all mad. That, to be fair, that is very typically Final Fantasy. Like, most Final Fantasy games, the final boss will be like a sequence of bosses.
I have no problem with like different phases and all the rest of it. But
even the other world, like the other parallel dimension and shit, that happens a lot. And
yeah.
Final Fantasy fans, I think it's the case that most fans are kind of always a bit, what the fuck is this shit? Like, I certainly was. Like, there's my favorite Final Fantasy ever. And this isn't a Final Fantasy podcast, so we'll move off this now after this because we talked about 15. But just as a thing. My favorite Final Fantasy is 9. I think it's the best one ever. Possibly the best JRPG ever. But the end final boss... The ending's fantastic, by the way. But the end final boss is so weird. Because Kuja is the villain, right? Kuja is the villain. He's a very good villain. It builds up to this final fight against Kuja. You beat Kuja. And you're like, oh, cool! I defeated Kuja and now everything's fine. And then this fucking guy comes down. And he's like, is this some random guy you've never seen or heard of before? And he's like, oh, I think his name is Necron. And he's like, I am Necron. Kuja's actions have proven to me that humankind does not deserve, not humankind, but like life does not deserve to exist. Life is undeserving of its existence. It's ungrateful. And I'm going to wipe out everything. And you're just like, who the fuck are you? Like, where did you come from? What is this? So, and it was also unnecessary because the final boss fight with Kuja is really good.
Yeah.
So it's like, what the fuck is this shit? So, I don't know, Final Fantasy always kind of pulled stupid shit like that, and it never really made sense, but whatever. Mm. Let's talk about something else.
Well, like, obviously, I've talked before about my love of the Mass Effect games, and Mass Effect 3 has obviously had that huge campaign to change the ending, like, how dare you...
Okay, so as someone who's never played Mass Effect, what the fuck was that about?
Alright, so the Mass Effect 3 ending, the problem was is that during the development and during the production and the media and everything, Casey Hudson, the director of it, and other people were like, oh yeah, all your choices will matter, like, at the end.
Oh, right, right, right. Mm.
So all the choices you made in previous games, they will lead you in, like, they will lead to choices at the end. And
it's like 3 will read your save files from 2 and 1.
Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. Right. And so fans, or some fans, were like, oh, okay, so this means that right at the end of the game, of a 40-hour experience, like, total, like, including DLC, maybe 60-hour right, experience, right. Yeah, yeah. Your, like, all the decisions that you've made will tailor a very special, like, ending
perfectly reasonable.
Just for you.
Perfectly reasonable,
like,
something.
Yeah, yeah, like how easy is that to develop? And so people got pissed off because they were like, oh, it's just a different color palette, like, that choose from your ending. You have 3 choices at the end, like, destroy all the robots, control the Reapers, the big bad guys, or synthesize. If you do enough things right, you can synthesize between humans and robots so that there will no longer be a need for the Reapers, who are just trying to harvest organic life.
Right, okay.
And so... And
so you get those 3 options regardless of what you've done before?
Yes.
Right, okay, okay, I see. So, yeah, so that's why people were pissed off.
Yeah, that's okay. Why people were pissed off. Forgetting as well the fact that somebody leaked the ending of Mass Effect 3 before it was even finished.
Oh, shit, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was supposed to be all about, like, dark energy and stuff like that. Which was, a side plot thing in Mass Effect 2. And that was supposed to lead into Mass Effect 3, and it was supposed to be the source of the Reaper's power. So they had to, like, go back and redo the ending, as well.
Damn.
Like, you know, so there was a lot of, like, reasons why, and secondly, yeah, like, as I was just kind of saying, like, you know, yes, you're given 3 options, but the ending of the game is not the ending of the trilogy. The ending of the trilogy is the entire game. Mm. So all the decisions that you made before do affect the entire game.
Right. Yeah, that's, like, a good way of looking at it, actually. Yeah.
Like, who you have on certain planets, how you save them, what's happening, who you will have when it comes to the final battle, how you can deal with certain situations, that is all part of the ending, and that is all reflected by choices you made in previous games. Like, your choices do matter in Mass Effect 3
because they bring you to Mass Effect 3.
Yeah,
I know what you mean.
Like, you do have a more unique and more tailored experience throughout the whole of Mass Effect 3, not just a individually tailored ending for your personal preference, but whether you were a renegade or a paragon of virtue before, like, you know, whether you were, like, whether you saved Caden or Ashley on Vermeer in the very first game, like, these choices all matter.
Right, right, yeah. That's a good way of looking at it. I don't think I've never heard that way of looking at it before, but it's actually, I would agree with it, like, the idea that the ending to Mass Effect 3 isn't the ending of the trilogy. Mass Effect 3 is the ending of the trilogy. So the choices you've made up to that point will get you to the ending.
Yeah.
And then you play through it, and the ending ends the way it ends. And that's
Yeah. Like,
okay.
You can't, like, you know, it's a long game.
Mm.
You can't, like, I think sometimes...
But why do you think, like, I mean, do you think that the fact people were pissed off about it, is it because their choices didn't affect the ending, or was it because the 3 options weren't very good, or weren't presented very well?
Like, I mean, that may well be part of it, like, particularly considering they retroactively put in one, an ending where you could just refuse all 3 options and let the Reapers win, and then the next cycle would defeat the Reapers using all the experience that you had before.
Oh, I see.
So, like, I mean, that's fine, like, but, like, you know, like, it's kind of like a Cthulhu game, though. These things, like, the Reapers are beyond our understanding of what life is, what synthetics are, and how to defeat them shouldn't be as easy as, like, oh, we just press a button, and they're all destroyed.
Right, okay.
Like, you know, it's, like, you know, like, you can't defeat Cthulhu by shooting rocket launchers at it. Like, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you kind of have... you have to find different ways around it. And, like, and one of the... In the, like, the destroy ending, where you do destroy them, you destroy all synthetic life. Right. Including some of your allies and friends. Like, you know, it is not, like, an easy choice. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, to, like, is that the right thing to do and all the rest of it? You're, like, you have saved this entire race of robots in one kind of playthrough. You've saved them. And now you're going to destroy them because it includes destroying the Reapers? Like, and that's, so that's not an easy choice.
No, that's difficult, yeah.
And, like, so I think if you haven't prepared enough and all the rest of it, like, you destroy a lot more than just synthetic life. You would destroy, like, serious part, like, you know, the explosion is so big and uncontrollable, and because you haven't prepared enough, like, you destroy large parts of Earth, you destroy, like, you know, the way that people get around the galaxy. Like, it's not as black and white as people kind of make it out to be.
Right, okay. What did you choose?
I always choose destroy.
You do choose to destroy.
I mean, I've done all three.
Which one felt like the better ending?
Destroy.
Okay.
Like, for my shepherds, my canonical shepherd or headcanon shepherd, yeah, destroy is the best one because they've been fighting the Reapers for too long.
So, in your opinion, let's take it back to the central question.
Yeah.
Does that ending matter? Like,
no.
Does it color at all negatively or positively your experience of Mass Effect, or have you already made up your mind by the time you get there what you think of it?
I personally, because there's a scene right before it, right before you have to make these horrible choices, like, you know, there's a scene between you and your commanding officer, which is touching, humane, and, like, and brings me to tears every single time.
Right.
That the rest of the game doesn't matter. Like, the whole game has been filled with moments like that, like, where they've been emotional and exhausting and, like, desperate and elating and, like, you know, the entire game has been, and including, if you include the Citadel DLC, moments of fun, because that you, for the whole Citadel DLC, you go through trying to chase down your evil clone. like, it is so genre savvy and, like, aware of itself.
Well, I guess that like, kind of relates to what we just said about Final Fantasy in a way, in that, like, we're finding our own narrative lines within the narrative line. Like, you're kind of going, okay, well, the ending is here at the end of that line. There's the ending to the story. But what you just said is that you found a perfectly fine way to end it for you was the scene directly before that. And it's like, that sums up how you feel about the whole thing, right?
As far as an emotional ending, yes. That was it.
So maybe the real end, maybe the actual ending is kind of superfluous in a way.
But I don't think it should color the rest of the experience either. Like, if you, like, because I saw, like, on Metacritic, people would give this, like, 1 out of 10 and all the rest of it. It's just like, Was the rest of the previous, like, 50 hours nothing? Like, I mean,
shout out here to Mark Kermode. He just did a really good video on Metacritic and aggregators.
Yeah.
And how they are not your friend.
No.
He does it in the context of Black Panther, which is poised to get that kind of treatment.
Yeah.
It's a really good video. He breaks down very, very eloquently why. How and why they've become popular, and also secondly why they're really not a particularly good metric
for judging
the quality of something. So it's worth a watch. Mark Kermode, I think it's called
Is it Kermode Uncut?
No, Kermode Uncut. Panther Hunter. Okay. Panther Hunting. What it is. It's really good. That's a case. So in my case, Final Fantasy XV presents an ending where the ending matters because it saves the rest of the story.
Yeah.
In your case, Mass Effect 3 is an example of where the ending doesn't matter, despite the criticism it gets, because everything that came before it was so solid, right, that the ending is kind of just not really so important. Where do we go with something like Overwatch, which has lore...
doesn't have a beginning or a middle or an end.
But this is the thing, right? Because it doesn't have a story. The key... the key media component, the game, doesn't give you a story, but it presents you with a world, and it presents you with a sequence of events, and fans are now kind of making their own stories and waiting for Michael Chu to kind of tell us what's going to happen. But it's blatantly obvious to anyone with an outer sense that we're never going to see an ending to that story. But does that matter? Clearly not.
Where do we go with WoW? I mean, like, it's the same thing. There's never going to be a narrative ending to WoW, because it's a massive multiplayer game.
But it's slightly different, because in Overwatch you have a set of characters, each of whom have a narrative. So there is each character has a narrative line. It's just not given to us. We're shown kind of bits and pieces of it and told, well, think about it. Maybe you can assemble it yourself. You know what I mean? Maybe the fans can assemble it, maybe. And we might give you a comic book here and there that'll fill it out. But it doesn't drive your... Like, I would say 70%, at least 70% of the people who play and enjoy Overwatch have no idea about its narrative lines.
Yeah.
So... that would be a case that proves our theory that endings don't really matter. They don't, not even that, but narrative doesn't really matter.
But you're taking it out into a very specific context there. Like, I mean, I think when we're talking about endings, we are talking about games that do have endings.
But
this cake ending is terrible.
Well, let's talk about some famous game endings then, because there is one specific ending that I want to get to, but once I start talking about it, I won't stop talking about it, so we won't go there.
Another one that, like, annoyed a lot of fans, and me being the outlier, I loved it, was Life is Strange. Did you ever play that?
I've never played it.
It's a really good game, and it looks beautiful, because they water painted all the scenes, all the characters, and then like fitted them into the 3D world and started modeling them like that. So everything looks gorgeous, and it's a really just like emotional story about two teenage girls, one of whom has the ability to control time a little bit, like she can go back in time, like Max and Chloe. Basically, Max keeps on having these visions of a great storm that's going to swallow up, like, her town and kill everyone. And she's, like, trying to stop that from happening, but she's also trying to solve the murder of Chloe, her best friend's other friend, or the disappearance, as it is, and then you find out she was murdered. And, like, so there's a lot of things going on and all the rest of it. And it basically comes down to a choice at the end. Do you go back in time and save, like, allow Chloe to die and save Arcadia Bay, the town?
Mm.
Or do you save Chloe and let the town die? And considering the main narrative thrust, like, throughout the whole game has been protect Chloe. It's been an interesting thing, and people hated it. People were like, well, there must be a way to get around it, or there would be a way to do it. It's like, no,
you can save Aerith.
Why is there people are like, why is there a town? Why is this the result of Chloe living and all the rest of it without, you know, ever reading any of the diaries, listening to any of the dialogue? They must not have been playing the same game, because it's very, very clear. It's like, you know, Max got these powers at a serious moment of stress. Yeah, so that's how they developed, and since she started abusing it, this, like, weird shit keeps happening. Like, the, at one moment it starts snowing, despite the fact that it's like 25 degrees outside.
Okay.
And then there's a solar eclipse. Then all these whales wash up onto the beach, dead, like in a great, like, you know, tide of them. And then eventually this storm. And the basic point is that her time manipulation is fucking with the universe.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's why all these things are happening.
Okay.
And if she keeps on using it, it leads to the storm, or she can go back in time and not use it at all. Mm. or not even get the powers. And people hated this. And it was like, it's a binary choice ending. It's like, there was always just a binary choice. Mm. It was always either save Chloe, don't save Chloe. That was always, like, throughout the entire game, that has been the choice.
But does it, as an ending, is it really, do you feel like the ending matters?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, because this one does. It's like, this one does matter because it's about how are you playing the game. Are you playing it as Max, or are you playing it as yourself? Because I think most people, given the choice between saving one person, between saving a whole town, they're going to choose the whole town.
It's that train track dilemma.
Yeah. You know, that's perfectly reasonable. But Max is a teenage girl. Chloe is, like, her first real romance, her best friend and all the rest of it. Like,
it's a much more complicated
thing. Yeah, if you play as Max, if in your head you're playing as Max, it's a very difficult choice.
So the ending ultimately reflects on everything, on your whole interpretation of the game.
Yeah, it really
matters in that case.
Yeah.
I see, okay. Okay, maybe I have to play Life is Strange.
Oh, you should play it anyway. It's just so good. Oh, it's so good.
I've got a fucking backlog and a half.
Yeah, how's The Witcher 3?
I don't even start. So here's my backlog as of last fucking Christmas, right? I still have to play The Witcher 3. Right now, I'm halfway through the campaign on Battlefront 2. I just finished Assassin's Creed Origins. So next, I still have to play The Witcher 3. What else have I got? The Rise of the Tomb Raider.
Titanfall 2.
I never finished World of Final Fantasy because it pulled a fucking shitty trick that I fucking hated, and it wants me to go and revisit all the maps and find MacGuffins. I'm like, I fucking traveled this entire map and fought all your little bullshit monsters. I am not doing it again. Fuck you. So I put that shit away. Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess HD Remaster. I never even touched that yet. And then this Christmas, my family very generously gifted me The Last Guardian and Horizon Zero Dawn. So,
Horizon's good. Jess has just finished playing it. She's currently going through it on New Game Plus.
I'm dying to get to it, man, but I don't know what to do. So, Life is Strange, maybe I'll get to it, but it'll be a while. Anyway. So that's an example of... We have Final Fantasy XV as an example of a game where the ending matters, either in my case because it saves the rest of the narrative, and in your case because it kind of is tonally in context with the rest of the narrative. Mass Effect 3 as an example of the ending that potentially doesn't really matter,
or you see it in a different you see what an ending is in a different light.
Right. And then Life is Strange, an example of where it really does matter because it reflects on how you've interpreted everything before.
Okay, so let's go on to your big one.
Are you sure?
Let's go on to your big weeb culture. Are you sure? Yeah.
Here we go. This is going to become the Evangelion podcast.
Oh, God. All right.
Now, we will have one on Evangelion at some point in the future, because we've talked about that already, but this isn't it. I'm going to keep this as concise as I possibly can. I'm not going to give a plot summary for Evangelion, and I'm going to try and keep it as, not spoiler-free, because it's kind of impossible, but I'm going to be as vague as I can,
okay, right,
in terms of the actual plot details. So Evangelion is the ultimate postmodern narrative. This is where postmodern pop cultural narrative peaks, because the levels at which you can interpret the various strands of Evangelion are just fucking nuts, and there's no end to them. So whether or not that was intentional on the part of Hideki Anno, the guy who created it, I have no idea. And no one does. And that kind of bleeds into the postmodern thing again, right? It's like, well, his intentions don't really matter. It's like, it exists now in this sphere of fan interpretation, and whatever you take from it is whatever you take from it, and that's fine. So basically, the story of Evangelion's ending is what I'm going to focus on, because, like I said, I could talk about the series and the various threads for hours, but I won't. Evangelion's ending is, again, like I used the word earlier, but I think it's a good word, is kind of a meme now. It's like a pop cultural thing that anyone who is into anime or anything nerdy, even if you've never seen Evangelion, you've probably heard the name, and the one thing you're probably aware of, or possibly aware of, is that the ending was controversial, right? It's talked about in a lot of circles. What happened was a few different things. The famous story is that the studio ran out of money. Towards the end of Evangelion, it was quite popular, but the studio got hit with tax evasion. They were evading tax, and so they were fined a lot of money, and they didn't have enough money to put together the big finale that they wanted to. This is the meta theory on what happened, right? Now, Hideki Anno has a very different take on this, right? But the idea was, the fan belief is that they wanted to make this big, huge finale, this big, massive robot fight finale thing for Evangelion, which is ostensibly a mecha anime. But they couldn't afford to, because they ran out of money. So the final two episodes of Evangelion, the original TV series, episodes 25 and 26, take place entirely within the characters' heads, as their consciousness and their psyche reacts to what's going on outside. Right, so you don't actually see anything of what's going on outside. It's hinted at in still frames, but the still frames in the show, they're presented to you out of context, so you don't know what you're looking at. So there's no way of knowing that's what's going on until you visit the movie that was made later, which I'll get to later. but so in the moment, you're just watching a random collection of kind of like the characters responding to stuff that you don't know what's going on, and it's presented within the framework of their. Something is interrogating them. They're sitting in dark rooms, and text appears on the screen with questions, and the characters answer the questions. And it's questions like, what are you afraid of? What do you fear? Are you afraid now? These kind of things. And it's kind of strange and bizarre and weird. And then it devolves. It gets even weirder when it becomes...
But it's an anime. It's already weird.
Well, yeah, but it becomes this... extended conversation in episode 26, it becomes this extended conversation about what it is to be alive, and is freedom even a real thing? Can you ever be absolutely free? And the idea is that at one point, Shinji, the main character, is in this space where he just wants to be free of everything. He's like, I can't take life anymore, I want to be completely free of everything. So they put him in this white space, and it's just a white screen, and Shinji's voice says, what is this? And there's no Shinji. You can't see anything. It's just white. And they say, well, this is freedom. You have no restrictions. There's no limitations on what you can do. You're free. But you can't understand the freedom because you have no limitations.
Mm.
So he says, okay, well, I need something. So they give him a floor. It's like, okay, well, now you can't go further than here. So you're free within this limitation. And now you have a body. So now you're free within the limitations of your body. Right? So it's like, it kind of explores that idea. So it explores all these crazy concepts, like these big concepts. And then in the end, it ends with Shinji accepting that although life is hard, it's worth living. Because the very act of existing is in itself an expression of power and an expression of agency. And if you exist, you can affect the world around you in ways that maybe you don't understand or are not aware of, but there's something you can do, and that agency shouldn't be wasted. And so even if you feel like, oh, I'm useless, I can't do anything, I'm a horrible person, well, okay, you're not dead. You're not nothing. Okay. You're here. And you could be dead. You could be nothing, but you're not. So do something. And it ends with everybody clapping and saying congratulations for his realization. Right?
Yeah.
But that's literally it. Everyone says congratulations, right? But there's no fucking, it never leaves their head. The ending happens in this weird kind of sphere looking thing. So no one who watched that show ever found out what actually happened to these characters. It's never actually, it all takes place in their minds. So the fans went fucking crazy. They hated it, right? They despised this ending. It was like famously reviled, and they wrote hate mail and all this kind of shit. So Evangelion obviously became hugely popular. It became a huge moneymaker, despite the fact that it was losing money during its production run. And they decided, you know what? Let's make a movie. Right? So the first thing they did was they made a recap of the series, which wasn't a very good movie, and then they made this thing called The End of Evangelion. Literally called that in Japanese too, in English, The End of Evangelion. And it's supposedly
everything the fans wanted.
It's, well, here's the thing: it's supposed to supersede episodes 25 and 26. It's meant to replace them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's presented as episode 25 and episode 26 with title cards and a credit sequence between them.
Oh wow!
So apparently some people walked out of the cinema after episode 25 because the credits run. But there was another one after that. So it is presented as fuck episode 25 and 26. This is the new episode 25 and 26. And so a lot of people believe that's true. I don't. But basically the end of Evangelion is the opposite of the TV ending. It is purely from the perspective of outside. So you see everything that's happening.
Right.
All the shit that the characters reacted to in their minds in episode 25 and 26, you get to see happening now.
Mm.
And it's bloody and it's brutal and it's quite a step. Evangelion as a series is kind of dark and psychological and strange, but it's never it's never bluntly violent.
Yeah.
But there's some pretty fucking intense violent imagery in this movie early on, like.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of took me off guard, and especially later on. There's one sequence where one of the Evangelions is eaten by a bunch of other Evangelions, and it's pretty disturbing, and it's quite unlike anything that happens in the TV show.
Yeah.
So it's very strange. It's really, really bizarre. And then the ending, again, it sinks back into psychological madness and kind of Shinji accepting what's going on around him, blah, blah, blah. But the ending to End of Evangelion is kind of the complete opposite. The ending to End of Evangelion is Shinji rejecting the idea that he has any responsibility. Completely saying, no, fuck it. I don't want anything to do with that shit. I don't want anyone. Everyone hates me. I hate everyone. Life is horrible, right? And it ends with him trying to choke another character. They're the only two people left in the world. And he's trying to choke her. He fails at that because he can't succeed at anything. And she calls him pathetic. She says, I feel disgusting or I feel sick. Whatever. The line's been interpreted a bunch of different ways. But she basically expressed a disgust towards him. As, like, you're a pathetic individual. Right? So this is the complete opposite story. Right? It's this. It's the same two episodes. Same ending. But the conclusion at the very end is totally different. The same events lead to, in the TV ending, Shinji accepts that he has responsibility because he exists, and he has to exist in the world in a way that will manifest his meaning. And in the movie ending, he says, no, don't want any meaning, don't want any responsibility, life is shit, everyone needs to die, that's it, right? So it's completely opposite endings. The reasoning for this, apparently, and again, it's all fan theory, but Hideki Anno fucking hates otakus. And he's talked about it a lot. He fucking hates otaku, and like he trolls Evangelion fans like no one else in the world. Like someone asked him a question about Evangelion and its relationship to psychology, and his response was, they asked him a really long question. I can't remember what the question was, but it was something like about Asuka representing the id and Shinji representing the superego or something like that. And his response was, these characters are really interesting. I had no idea they were so interesting when I wrote them. So he loves trolling the fans, right? So,
but I was just writing blank slates. Like.
This is it, right? So does, in Evangelion, right, the ending matters hugely because you've got two endings. And which one you like.
Does that mean they matter, though?
They matter in the sense that they completely change everything. It reframes everything that happened up to that point. Like, if you see Evangelion from the beginning to the TV ending, where Shinji has this realization of his own power and his own kind of determination to make a good life and live well in the world, it makes it a coming-of-age story, almost. Everything that he goes through to get to this point is worth it, because at the end of it he realizes, holy shit, like all that shit I went through, that's part of life, and I have to accept it and I have to embrace it, and I can have the good but I have to also take the bad too. Whereas if you take the movie ending, the End of Evangelion ending, he learns nothing. So he goes through all this shit and then there's no payoff. He just his life is just awful. So the ending absolutely 100% colors what you take from the whole thing. And it also matters in the case of in the sense that there's a really strong evidence to suggest that that ending was literally made as a fuck you to the fans who didn't like the original ending. Because he's like, there's a great moment in it, there's a fantastic moment in End of Evangelion where Hideki Anno basically calls out otakus for being leery. Like, it's beautiful. It's so good. Like, and not just otakus, but like anime makers.
Yeah.
He calls him out for being kind of leery and pervy, right? There's a moment when Shinji, it's kind of in the stream of consciousness thing, and he's coming to terms with his own uselessness and stuff, and he's kind of saying, a voice in his head is saying, like, how could anyone ever, why did you think any of the girls in your life would ever be attracted to you? Like, what did you have to offer, right? And he says, like, oh, it doesn't matter if I had anything to offer because they're all mean and they all hated me anyway, right? And this whole kind of thing of the girl saying to him, did you ever actually try to get to know us? Did you ever actually try to offer anything to us?
Hideki Yama predicting MRAs.
Right, but this is it. But while it's happening, right, it's presented as a disembodied voices with a Shinji in the center of the screen, but layered over him are shots of Asuka, Ritsuko, Misato, and Rei, all the girls, are shots of their legs, their necks, their cleavage. Like, all this is layered over it, right? So it's like, this is what you wanted, right? These shots are what you came here for, right? Okay, well, here they are. But I'm going to fucking talk to you like you're a fucking leery, pervy bitch, like, while you're looking at them. Are you happy now? So it's like this. It is in many ways a meta commentary on the fans who are watching it. And there's one point where you see an empty auditorium, like real video, not animation.
Oh wow!
Of an auditorium. So it's literally like turning the camera around and looking at the audience, right? So it is absolutely a meta commentary on the people watching it in general. So the ending invites you to, the ending almost forces you to kind of go, how do I feel about this? And how do I feel about what it says about everything else? Because it tells you openly, it's like, this is about you as much as it is about these characters.
Okay.
So the ending to Evangelion is a fascinating topic. And I think that in terms of having the two endings, and there is a third one coming, because we're one film away from finishing a four-film run of the Evangelion story, which may or may not be a reboot, or may or may not be a sequel continuation of the actual thing, we don't know, but there's a third ending coming. But these two endings are fascinating in terms of how they colour everything else that comes before them.
So, okay, so let's try and bring this to some kind of conclusion.
Okay.
What do ending, like, in the end, in our thesis, do endings matter, like, in the context of a narrative? Like, I mean, is it entirely dependent on what came before it, or is it like what you bring to it? Or, and given our kind of our meta topic for this season, should fans shut up about endings a bit?
Well, I think Hideki Anno would say yes. Okay, so let's look at the four that we've talked about, right? So we said that Final Fantasy XV, the ending mattered because it justified or kind of
followed on
naturally from everything that came before it.
Yeah.
Right? So in that case, it mattered.
Right.
Because in your case, it bookended what was overall a very campy experience, mm-hmm. with a nice bookend, campy kind of bookend.
Yeah.
And in my case, it kind of was presented so beautifully that it kind of made up for the fact that the rest of the story was a bit shitty, right? So in that case, it mattered, because it functioned in a way that painted everything that came before it in an enjoyable light, right? Colored over, like, painted over the cracks, kind of colored over the bits that you didn't like. Mass Effect 3, we said the ending didn't matter because there was enough in what came before.
Yeah.
That the ultimate conclusion of the narrative line was not so important.
Yeah.
Life is Strange, we said it mattered because
Life is Strange matters because it is the final conclusion of how you played the game.
Right, yes, yeah. So it tells you how you interpreted everything that came before.
Yeah.
And Evangelion matters because of the same reason.
I know, I would say, like, a good companion piece to Life is Strange is probably something like Prey, the new Prey.
Oh, okay. Because quite interesting comparison.
No. Yeah. As far as the ending goes, is because basically you're given like really shitty psychology tests at the beginning.
Okay.
While you're the test subject, but like extra credits did a really really good video about it. But basically they say like, okay, you took the psychology test, you answered them. Now let's see if you actually do use these answers, if your mentality works that way when you play the rest of the game.
Right, okay, so it checks you again.
Yeah. So, like, throughout gameplay, you do test to see if you think that protecting the many is better than just protecting the few.
Okay.
Are you creative in using the thing? And at the very end of the game, it's revealed that you are an alien.
Oh, shit.
And that you have to decide whether humanity is worth saving or worth killing.
Oh, right.
And,
okay.
Like, and through your test, through your experience, through, like, everything else, you have kind of, like, so it is kind of a good sister one to Life is Strange. Is how have you been playing this game?
Okay.
So.
Well, then it seems like the conclusion that we've come to is that endings matter in terms of how they reframe or justify what leads up to them.
Okay.
And if the ending doesn't necessarily comment on what happened before it in a way that's meaningful, then they kind of become irrelevant.
Okay, yeah. So wait, does that mean Mass Effect 3 is a bad ending?
It's not. No, I mean, good and bad are objective markers that will be different for everybody, but what we're talking about is meaning.
Okay.
And does the ending carry any weight? Does it carry more weight or an equal amount of weight to the narrative threads that preceded it?
Okay.
Right? And in the case of Mass Effect, it's no. Right? The ultimate ending to that game is an ending. It might be a good ending, might be a bad ending, but as far as you were concerned, all the kind of the meaning and the narrative lines of kind of emotional importance and stuff had been finished by the time you got there.
Yeah.
So you'd gotten everything that you needed to in terms of what the game was saying to you before you got to that ending. Whereas I would say with something like Evangelion, which ending you think is better, which ending you prefer more, tells you how you feel about everything else that led up to it. So it's a case where the ending really does matter. And the reason I like this question is because I don't think saying the ending matters or the ending doesn't matter at all is a criticism of the thing.
Yeah.
I like this topic because it kind of proves that
narrative is more than just its conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Narrative is not just this line that you go from A to B and at the end of it you're finished. It's like, no. There's other stuff in there.
Yeah.
You know, and even if the conclusion isn't great,
I mean, Christ, we judge Skyrim by its story. Like, it'd be the worst game ever. Like, no, I'm serious. Fucking hate Skyrim story. But yeah, like, no, I mean, that's a good point. So, I mean, let's think about the Last of Us ending. I mean, which we argued about a lot. I mean, the standard ending for that would have been that Joel allows the thing to happen and the world is saved.
Yeah.
He saved the world. But no, he lied, and he had to go through all that, like, you know, he had to doom humanity, basically.
Yeah. And I would say that's an ending that matters, because, like we said, it reframes everything that came before it. Like, our conversation with The Last of Us, we won't get into it again, but our conversation about that, I mean, if anyone goes back and listens to it again, the interesting thing was that we were arguing, but we weren't disagreeing.
Yeah.
Like, we were arguing about what it meant.
Yeah.
As opposed to what actually happened. Like, because you were saying Joel's an asshole, and I was like, yeah, he is. And that's what's kind of, it's the end of the game kind of colors everything that happened before as he's being so selfish. Like, why did he attach himself to Ellie so much? Is it for her sake, really? Because if it was for her sake, what she wanted was to die for the sake of humanity. So is it really for her? I don't think. You know what I mean? So yeah, it colors everything that I ate before. So in that case, that ending matters. But yeah, I think that's the conclusion. Does the ending reflect on what happened before it in a way that's very meaningful?
Yeah.
And if it does, then it matters. And if it doesn't, then it doesn't matter. And ultimately, that doesn't really tell you anything about the overall objective quality of a thing. It just tells you about the narrative line.
Yeah, or like, yeah, just the narrative conclusion.
Mm, yeah, yeah. Well, that was over an hour. That was intense, man. Yeah. That was intense. I enjoyed it, though.
A lot of describing video games and TV series.
Yeah, yeah, Jesus, yeah. Yeah. But still, I enjoyed that. I hope people enjoyed listening to it. So thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, you can catch us on Twitter at...
Wayne Podcast.
Or you can email us at... was it Wayne Podcasts? @gmail.com. And if you're listening, whoever has waynepodcast@gmail.com, singular, fuck you. All right? Fuck you. Jesus Christ.
Just really? Why?
Yeah, what are you doing? What does Wayne stand for? Where, what am I missing? What are you? What the fuck is that? Anyway, thank you for listening. Let us know what you think in the comments or in an email or in a tweet, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.